Hello, 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 and welcome, 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 welcome to the Storytelling with Puck podcast. We will, as always, start with a story. Indeed we will, and this story is the story of stories. The story that brings every opening story from series one of the Storytelling with Puck podcast to one place. The story that will make you laugh, make you cry, make you wretch, make you smile, and most importantly, the story that will connect you to each of our incredible guests on a deeper level. As with many stories, this one will start by looking through the eyes of a child. It was the summertime for Kayla Conley. A time to play, a time to feast, a time for progress.
The story I'll read for you is called Summertime at Granny's House. Now, my granny was an amazing woman, and you'll get a taste of what she's like and what summertime was like in the Caribbean with my granny, Lynette. Do you remember the long days of your summer holiday with nothing to do but play? We were sent to Granny's house to spend our summer holiday, and we all rebelled at how Granny lived in the country and she doesn't have a telly. We told our mother we don't want to go. There was one bus that could take us to Granny's house, a bus called Progress. The bus was strapped with sugarcane, breadfruits, yams, bags and baskets, and bananas that belonged to the hagglers. Because Jamaica had a hilly interior, the bus would drive through the valley to get to Granny's house. And for us, that was a five-hour trek. The engine would choke sluggishly in fourth gear through mountain roads, twisting and turning. Granny's house had four bedrooms. There was a kitchen and a bathroom outside. But if the weather was fine, we were expected to use the facilities outside. Granny's house didn't have a number in the district. They didn't have a post office either. They have a PA, and that's a postal agency. I asked Mama, how can we be sure that we have reached Granny's house? She said, press the bell as soon as you see the jackfruit tree. Can you imagine? Three little girls on a bus looking for a jackfruit tree all night. We finally arrived at Granny's house, and she hugged and kissed us. She was so happy to see us. But in no time, Granny got down to business. Granny had three rules. Empty the chamber pots first thing in the mornings. Eat what you're given, and do not touch her vanity set. I got up one morning, and I realized Granny's kitchen was pitch black with smoke. You can't see properly in the kitchen, and your eyes would water from the sting of the smoke that came from the wood fire. While I would squint when looking for ingredients, Granny knew where every seasoning was. There was a small window to the right of the kitchen, and she had no electricity in there. There was a piece of chicken wire that hangs precariously over the wood fire. And you know what Granny called that? She called that her kreng kreng. That's what Granny used to smoke her own meat. It wasn't a surprise to see a pig's tail pressed against it whenever you look up. Granny had a large pot with three legs that was always bubbling away violently like a witch's cauldron. And each bubble would bring up the odd green banana or dumpling. The pot was made from cast iron, and after you have had dinner from it, your iron intake would never deplete. On Sundays, Granny puts on her Sunday best to get ready for church. As one of her rules was not to go into her bedroom, I would peep through the crack of her bedroom door. When Granny takes that bright pink powdered puff and doused herself with powder, you can't see anything in the room. And in that moment, I pictured Granny appearing on stars in their eyes, saying, "Tonight, Matthew, I'm going to be Mahalia Jackson or Aretha Franklin." When the time came to leave the country, I realized that the country had become my Garden of Eden. I was allowed to lounge guilt-free under the intense expanse of blue sky, to dream and laugh and be, with no prospect of being disturbed to complete any urgent task. Granny's telly was there for all to see. There was so much beauty in the country. There were pine trees swaying in the gentle breeze, banana trees, cocoa and coffee beans, yams, potato, and sugarcane. The crickets chirped in the darkness while the ants gathered food for the rain and the storms ahead. The rooster struts proudly around the kitchen coop, and the hens scratch for the odd worm or two. And my cousins and I, we played from dawn until dusk. Our favorite game was to catch a firefly, or we call them Pini Wally in the Caribbean, and placed it in a bottle and watch as it lights up the room with its gentle glow. My cousins pushed me around in a wheelbarrow. We used catapult to knock out birds and roast them. We picked mangoes, oranges, and guavas, and we only got back to the house for tea. My granny, Lynette Stanberry, she is the rock of Gibraltar. I call her Venus on a mountain. She is the government of her land. She was a woman imbued with a clear spirit and an intrepid will and a burning love to make the countryside her oasis of calm. She lived off the bounty of the land and concocted a mixture of herbs to make her own medicine from the plants within her grasp. In an article written by Children's First magazine, it stated that children who are given the opportunity to have contact with nature through unstructured play have better physical health, increased creativity, reduced stress, and a greater awareness of the natural environment.
Playing, having fun, being one with nature, what joy it brings. Add some music, add some mischief, and you might start to hear the beat of your own drum. But what happens when somebody tries to take that all away? S.J. Woods can tell us more.
There once was a small child, happy in her own company, who loved music, art, and nature. She was full of fun and mischief, and had daily adventures in her back garden, which backed onto the woods. Whenever she felt afraid, she would sing to herself in the dark, the words of the songs bringing comfort to her, and she would sing herself to sleep. As she grew, she started to hear a drum beat, far away in the distance, which she could not resist. So one day, against her parents' wishes, she went to explore. She came across a witch who took away her music. She would not need it along this path, she said, and the girl closed her heart to song, but she still heard the drum calling, calling. Then she came across a wise man who angrily told her to put down her sketchbook. She would not have space to carry this on the path ahead, he said. And he gave her a heavy rock to carry in its stead. The drum still called to her as she dragged her feet forward across the dales and hills, calling, calling, calling. For years she travelled, adding rocks to her backpack through storms, hail, wind and snow, sometimes resting for a while in a warm, sunny place, but always moving on, pushing through and never giving up. Until one day, she came across a strong, tall oak tree. Its branches filled the sky and its roots sank just as deep into the earth. The dryad of the tree welcomed the weary, battered girl. "Come inside," she said. "Sit down. Rest here for a while." The girl sat down and they talked. They talked about her love of music, her joy of creating, and the stories of her journey. They laughed, they cried, as the years unraveled and the girl placed her rocks on the hearth, one by one. Once all that was said was needed to be said, the girl shut her weary, tear-stained eyes and listened. In the darkness, she found she was no longer afraid, and she could hear the drumbeat louder and louder. Her heart opened once again, and there she was, the woman with the drum. She had been there all along.
There's that drum, beating inside of us, keeping our inner child alive. Talking of keeping all of the children alive and safe, here's something by Ria Mulugi.
There once were three little girls who lived with their mother and grandmother. Their mother worked very hard to provide for them, and while she was out to work, she entrusted the care of the girls to their grandmother. They lived in an apartment block that was perfectly symmetrical and stood four stories high. Down the middle ran a stairwell, all the way from the ground floor to the fourth floor, separating the families on either side of the apartment block. The apartment of the little girls was located on the left-hand side of the top floor. The girls were very little. The eldest was 6 years old and the two youngest just four. The two youngest were slightly chubby with cute short little legs, while the older was lanky and scrawny. The grandmother loved the little girls very much and took very good care of them. Every day she would bath them and braid their hair. She would cook them soft porridge for breakfast, prepare sandwiches for lunch, and cook delicious meals for supper. They would ask her many questions, and she loved answering all of them. Whenever she did the laundry, she would use the communal lines located on the ground floor. Some days she would take the girls along with her and let them run around and play. Other days she'd leave them in the apartment but lock the main security gate so they would be safe inside. The grandmother and her immediate neighbor had grown to become great friends. One day, the grandmother was on her way down to the laundry line when the neighbor said to her, "Ma, there's no need to lock the gate today. I'm here. I'll keep an eye on them." The grandmother saw no harm in this and agreed. So off to the ground floor the grandmother went with the bucket full of laundry in one hand, bag of clothespins in the other, and her favorite blue hat for the sun snugly placed on the top of her head. In their usual tradition, she reached the communal line, looked up at them, and waved. The three little girls and the neighbor all excitedly waved back. There were lots of giggles this time, as this was new, having the neighbor included. Content, the little girls decided to go back into their apartment to play. The neighbor, on the other hand, had something cooking on the stove in her apartment and ran in quickly to check if everything was okay before coming back to keep an eye on the girls. It was during this very small window that one of the teenage girls who lived in the apartment block found her way into the apartment of the little girls. The gate was not locked, so access was easy. The teenage girl's name was Tessa, who suffered from a disability that severely impaired her speech and also contributed to a slight limp in her walk. Tessa was a wonderful girl, always happy and smiling, but when she got excited, things could get out of control. She would scream with excitement, clap her hands, and could easily run you over with one of her bear hugs. The little girls were not strangers to Tessa. In fact, they would sometimes play with her outside, among the safety of other kids in the apartment block, but never alone, as they were kids who scared easily. Tessa entered the apartment and, on catching sight of the little girls, clapped her hands and screamed with delight. The little girls had been sitting quietly, fully absorbed in reading their story books. On hearing the unwelcome screams, they all froze. They just sat there for a few seconds, eyes wide with shock, glaring at Tessa. This was not okay. Realizing they were all alone with her, they tried screaming back at her, "Leave, Tessa, please leave." But Tessa wasn't hearing any of it. She was here to visit her little friends and play. She stormed head-on towards them, screaming and wild with excitement. The youngest of the sisters could no longer restrain herself. This was too much. She threw the book off her lap and, screaming at the top of her lungs, and headed straight for the bedroom at top speed on tippy toes. Not far behind followed the other two, all screaming for their little lives. The youngest one reached the bedroom window first, pushed it wide open. Looking at her grandmother still hanging laundry on the ground floor, she screamed, "Gran, come help me! Come quick, Gran, please help us!" The grandmother looked up at the little girl, completely confused. Her friend, the neighbor, was supposed to be keeping an eye on them. What was going on? It wasn't long before Tessa followed all three into the bedroom, giggling and clapping, stretching her arms out for a hug. The screams even got louder. Tessa just wanted to play. The more the little girl screamed, the more excited Tessa became. For the little girls, there was no escape. In a frenzy, their younger sister screamed even louder, "Gran, come catch me!" Getting herself ready for the big jump, she climbed up onto the window ledge and screamed again, "Gran, come catch me quick!" The grandmother, in complete shock, just stood there looking up at the window, both hands on her head in complete disbelief. Screams continued to fill the apartment, which now caught the attention of the neighbors. The elder sister, helping the youngest one along, grabbed her around the waist, set her down on the window ledge with the little sister's legs hanging out of the window, ready to push when the moment came. The third little sister just stood there crying, waiting for her turn. The screams did not stop. "Gran, come catch us, quick!" And Tessa just kept looming closer and closer. In a flash, the neighbor entered the apartment, barged into the bedroom. In one swoop, she moved Tessa and the third little sister out of the way. She reached over the eldest sister, grabbed the youngest one into her arms, bringing her back in from the ledge. The three siblings, still trembling, held onto that neighbor for dear life. Some of the other neighbors came along to see for themselves what the commotion was all about. One of them proceeded to remove Tessa from the apartment. All Tessa wanted was to just visit her three little friends. She was gently escorted out, all the while giggling, clapping, and tugging at her hair. The grandmother climbed those stairs as fast as she could to get to the girls. With tears falling from her eyes, she scooped all three into her arms and hugged them as tightly as she could. Relieved, they clung to their grandmother. The grandmother glanced over to the neighbor with such disappointment. The neighbor's heart, heavy with guilt, pleaded to the grandmother, "I'm so sorry, Ma. I'm really sorry. Please forgive me." In response, the grandmother just nodded and looked the other way. Later that night, when the little girl's mother returned from work, she burst into tears listening to the events of the day. She held on to her three little girls tightly, kissing each of their little foreheads, refusing to let them go. The grandmother's eyes welled up with tears again as she saw her daughter's heart break with disappointment. What seemed like an innocent gesture almost ended in great tragedy.
Thankfully, there was no tragedy, but there certainly was trepidation. Imagine the trepidation the young men in Jules White's nail-biting story must have felt.
So, I was 14 years old, and me and my best buddy, Lisa Mate, who I fondly used to call Beanie, and she used to call me Beanie, I know no idea where that came from, we were going out with two lads who were in the year younger. So there's the first bit of drama. because that was like one of those taboo-y type things. So we were going out with younger boys, and I remember it was one summer and my parents were away somewhere. I had an older brother and sister, so we were allowed to be home alone, although I was the youngest. And we made a plan at school this one day. Well, it was hilarious. We decided that we would trick our boyfriends. We'd have them round to my house. We would then engage another friend of ours, Catherine Reiki. And I am naming names because none of these women have got the same names now. They're all married. So they remain anonymous. And Catherine Reiki was tiny and very athletic, and she would be the one that was going to be the trickster. And all will be revealed in a minute with this story. So we had made plans that that weekend I'd have the boys round to my house with Beanie, and we would have a lot of fun and laugh and play and whatever. And the dogs, I had three dogs, so they were also involved in this whole weekend. And they arrived, and it just so happened that as they arrived, the sky started to go really black, and we began to have a storm. Because, you know, I don't know so much whether we get the storms like this nowadays. I don't remember them today like back then, but we had this big, big thunderstorm brewing. So imagine we've got the dogs who were all alert because there's a storm on and they're barking and running around. We are then aware that we've left the back door of the house open in order for Catherine Reiki to come over the back fence into the back of the house and go upstairs. Meanwhile, the lads don't know anything about what we've got planned. And the principle of all of this was that we were going to scare them. We were going to tell them that the house was haunted. So they knew no one else was in the house. All of a sudden, banging comes from upstairs. The boys start to look a bit scared. Did you hear that? There was a noise. The dogs are barking. The thunder's rolling. And we know exactly what's going on. But wow, what's that then? We'll go and have a look. So then we start acting a little bit scared. And the boys are now going into macho mode. We'll go up, girls. We'll go and have a look. And as they came out of the lounge door, all of a sudden, at the bottom of the stairs, landed a tarot card. The card of death had fluttered down the stairs as if by magic and landed at the bottom of the stairs. So of course, we're all going along with this. Actually, I think we probably felt quite scared ourselves, even though we knew what was going on. Meanwhile, the boys have gone upstairs. We're scared because we're thinking they're going to find Catherine Reiki. Catherine Reiki has hid in the airing cupboard and buried herself under the towels in the airing cupboard, not to be found. So of course, it even gets better that there's nobody up there with all these noises. The boys run back downstairs. We're then aware that we heard another noise of banging down the stairs. And we presume that Catherine Reiki has exited the back of the house, jumped over the fence and gone. But one of the boys is missing. So we don't know when or how, but one of the boys has left the house too. So we're thinking, oh my goodness, this is all backfiring a little bit, because he was obviously so scared he ran. And then after about 15 minutes, there's a knock at our front door and one of the boys is still there. My boyfriend is missing. And at the front door is our religious education teacher, our RE teacher, Mr. Rowlands, with a Bible in his hand. He was a very religious man, saying in his best North Yorkshire accent, "I understand you've got a ghost. Would you like me to exorcise the house?" I'm not even lying. And we just looked at him horrified, cried and said, "You better come in for a cup of tea. We'll tell you what's been going on." Needless to say, I was no longer girlfriend of said lad. He finished our relationship, as did the other lad. So yes, we had we can laugh about it now, but actually we really did. The whole thing backfired on us quite badly.
Well, it looks like we're growing up a bit now. But let's not become adults just yet. Nicola Richardson is finding the middle ground by working as a youngster in her parents' cafe.
I think back to my childhood and I feel lucky with the experiences I had. Brought up in a cafe and homemade bakery from the age of 7, there was never a dull moment. The business was in the centre of a little village, and looking back, I can see Mum and Dad built up a community of support and encouragement for the youth and the elderly. I worked at the front of the house, serving and dealing with customers from a very early age. This was alongside my dad. Mum and Dad would always employ teenagers. As I said, they were willing to learn and adapt. Mum's one experience with an elder lady put her off for life, as the woman would not budge on anything. It was her way or no way. I learned so much from my parents and the way they involved their employees in the business. There was lots of fun and laughter and sometimes tears. Come January, we'd have a games night and a meal to recognise the hard work of all the staff. Other times, cakes were made for birthdays. And when on duty, the girls and boys would always get a hot meal and a break. I can recall Mum's laughter and her ability she had to get the girls and boys to work extremely hard. Many would come in for an extra mile at Christmas and other occasions in the early hours to assist with the baking. Again, this was full of laughter. Friendships were formed that have lasted over the decades and are still as part of my Facebook friends as well. I remember being extremely busy on one particular day and Mum was in the kitchen under immense pressure. We had a little hatch where she would check what was happening with the kitchen, share orders and get the meals through. On this particular day, my dad was barking his orders through the hatch. Now, bear in mind, he'd been in the RAF and he had led giving out orders on parade. So it was a bark. Mum was getting to the end of her tether and wasn't keeping up. Eventually, she lost her rag, throwing the food at the hatch next time Dad stuck his head through. Luckily, it missed and went down the wall. Of course, that meant she had to clear it up. So there's a moral there. One of Dad's favourite sayings was that the customer wasn't always right. And I think he had a point, actually. If customers were rude or obnoxious, then it simply wasn't tolerated. It was great because I learned from an early age to put my foot down with behaviour that was bad. Even on one occasion, throwing out a group of big fellas, and they were big, who had roared up on their big motorbikes and had been extremely rude to some of the customers and staff. I was only 16 at the time, but it gave me the skills that have played into my working life. If something's out of order, I will say and look to find ways to move things forward. At 17, my dad ended up in hospital for a major operation, and we knew it would be for a minimum of 2 weeks. I was in the middle of my A-levels. So it meant I ended up covering the front of the house and doing the jobs that Dad would do, including going to the cash and carry and other roles. This meant I wasn't getting much of my schoolwork done. But to me, that didn't matter. What actually mattered was loyalty to my parents' business and making sure it didn't falter. Several times a week, I would drive Mum the 40 miles to the hospital where we would be met with a grumpy man who was in pain and who didn't want to be in hospital. It was always a traumatic drive to the busy outskirts of the town, especially as I'd only just passed my driving test. Pretty traumatic, really traumatic, in fact. On one occasion, my car decided to break down, and with dusk approaching, the headlights went and then it started spluttering. Can you imagine the feelings I had, especially as I was new to driving? My heart sank, especially as we didn't have any breakdown cover. Luckily, my dear school friend and her family came to our rescue. So, Christine Connors, if you are listening, then I have never forgotten this. Absolutely saved my life that day. The business always had quiet times in January and February. And in those months, we would live by the skin of our teeth. Luckily, the one thing in plentiful supply was food and Mum's delicious home baking. interestingly, having been brought up in the war years, she knew how to eke out food in those months. Sundays and Mondays were the day we'd close in that period, as trade would be extremely slack. I used to love those days of closing, as we would play board games, sometimes by candlelight when the miners' strike was happening. Other times we'd travel to London and go to radio shows. Shows like New Seekers, Nana Mouskouri and others. All fun and great to be part of. I can still hear the roaring and them telling us to clap when the people came on. One of the things I remember as well in that period is Dad poring over the books and looking at trends, something that came useful for me later in my operational lead days. I remember little things like his making sure he recorded in his diary key points about the business. This sticks in my mind because when the tax man came calling, he never had any issues because of his spot on recording in the business. These were great times. And they influenced my childhood, and also it helped me with the skills in the workplace. So on that note, I just want to end with a few lines after a song sung by Mary Hopkins in 1969. Those were the days, my friend, we thought they would never end. Oh, my friend, we're older but no wiser, for in our hearts the dreams are still the same. And my final thought to leave you with is, do our dreams stay the same?
Dreams. Do they stay the same? Well, there are some dreams that you may well want to change, as Nick Diakonostasis will tell you.
This is a dream that I think really shows how we view transformation on an internal level. So once upon a time, a couple of years ago, I had this dream that I was wandering through the desert. And it was the kind of arid desert. There wasn't really sand. There was cracked ground more than anything. A few small dunes here and there. And I had no idea how I got there, which is quite a common theme in a lot of my dreams. I just find myself in a place and think, okay. I don't recall getting here, but let's see how I get out. And I was wandering around for what felt like absolute ages. And it all looked the same, so it was pretty hard to get out. And at some point, I can't tell you if it was minutes or hours later, I came across what seemed to be the remnants of some kind of car crash. There seemed to be just a little bit of a metal skeleton of a car lying there, kind of half buried within a dune. And I saw that, and I got this feeling of, uh-oh, I think this is bad. And not bad for the person who died in the crash, but bad for me. I could sense danger. So as I was thinking this, I could barely finish that thought. And then this man, let's call him, or what was left of him, came sprinting out of the dune. So it was what we would call a zombie in modern terminology. It was some kind of revenant, some kind of corpse, some kind of half-melted, half-decomposed man, and he was running really fast, though. He was not slowly ambulating towards me like in The Walking Dead. He was more like a World War Z kind of zombie. So he was sprinting like crazy. So I started running from him, and he caught up with me pretty quickly. And I'm pretty fast, so that was pretty scary that this half-melted corpse was that fast. And he tackled me to the ground, and he was screaming and roaring for my flesh. And I was trying to fight him off me, so I was on the ground on my back. He was on top. He was trying to claw and bite as much as he could out of me. And for a little bit, it seemed like I had him, but then I didn't, because he did manage to bend down closely enough to take a huge chunk out of my neck. So as he pulled back, you could see this ribbon of just flesh and tissue just ripping off. There was blood spurting everywhere. I was absolutely panicking. I thought, this is it. I am dead now. And as I had that thought, I recall being interrupted by, I don't want to say another thought. I would call it more like an instinct. So as I had this internal monologue of watching him pull whatever flesh and guts out of me from on top of me, thinking, this is it, this is the end, I'm done. before I could get to the done part, I just felt this surge of power inside me. And it was almost like a locked away memory had just been unlocked. Maybe it was a final safety net in my head somewhere, like a break glass in case of fire situation. So I could feel something trigger, and it was both power and memory. It was almost as if I remembered in that very moment, as I was about to die, who or what I actually was. And then I remembered, wait a second, I'm a force of nature. That thing can't kill me. Nobody can kill me. And then I felt the warmth surge up inside me. And then I transformed. And this is where the perspective shifts, because until that point, I was viewing it through my eyes, first person perspective. And then all of a sudden, it's as if the camera pulled away and I could see myself and the Revenant fighting. There was a flash and I just transformed into a flock of beautiful tropical birds. You know, the ones with a long ribbon tail and the crest, like a punk rocker. And we dispersed and that thing fell to the ground. It face planted. And we started flying around, swarming him and dive bombing him. It was like the tropical version of Hitchcock's Birds, just a lot prettier, because we were all these electric blue and teal and turquoise birds flying around, and that thing was thrashing around and screaming. It was trying to catch one of us, or one of me. I can't even say if I was a me or an us at that point. It was trying to catch us, but we were too fast. As we were swarming and dive bombing him, we started chipping away. You could see more and more tissue, more and more holes coming off from that thing. And I knew that we had him, and I knew that this is where we/I were going to end him. So in a final fell swoop, if you want to call it that, we all flew up high, very high into the sky, hundreds of feet probably. And we started shimmering really brightly, even more brightly than before. And then we just started dive bombing him as one. It was almost like a small teal meteor hit the scene. And I remember raining down on him and that thing getting blown apart. We left a crater. And I remember the very last thing before I woke up, zooming in on his head as I was dive bombing, looking through my eyes again and watching it pop open like a watermelon. And then boom, I woke up. And at that point, I knew that the scary things in my life coming ahead, because it was a time of uncertainty in the real life, not in the desert, I felt like I had it. I thought, okay, maybe I'm stronger and more resilient than I remember. So I woke up after all of this, feeling a lot of hope and feeling a lot of confidence.
It takes a lot to make those changes, to move on to the next stage of our stories, to feel more confident. Sometimes we need a push to start a change. Sometimes we need a moment, or in Rosalind Palmer's case, a Madonna moment. As we continue with these highlights, some of the stories touch on difficult subjects such as mental health challenges, abuse, and alcoholism. Please only listen if you feel you are able to, and get the help and support you need.
T.E. Lawrence said, "All men dream, but not equally. Those who dream by night in the dusty recesses of their mind wake in the day to find that it was vanity. But the dreamers of the day are dangerous men, for they may act on their dreams with open eyes to make them possible." My personal story. It was at Cardiff Millennium Stadium that my love affair with Madonna hit the rocks. I'd been a material girl, desperately seeking something. And the soundtrack to my life until that night in 2008 had been provided mostly by Madge. Sadly, she stepped out on stage late, gave a lackluster 45-minute performance, only connected with the audience at La Isla Bonita, and then, without an encore, left. My adoration had left with her. Perhaps I was growing old or growing up, but I was fed up. She'd sung Hung Up and I'd momentarily felt a bit better. I left feeling betrayed. Yet the lyrics to her song, Nobody Knows Me, would not stop playing in my head on repeat. The words, I've had so many lives since I was a child, and I realize how many times I've died. Nobody, nobody knows me. Nobody knows me. That is how I felt in my life. Misunderstood, lonely, like I kept living the wrong life and was an actress in a play I'd actually not realized I'd auditioned for. This pattern had been playing out for longer than I could remember. The most intense period of my life changing took place over an 18-month period between 2003 and 2005. My life imploded, stripping away almost everything I knew, cherished, connected to, and identified with. I went from a seemingly healthy and attractive 40-something who'd made a million from her amazing PR career, living in a beachfront house in the Bahamas, to a single, jobless mother in a rented house in England, having cancer treatment and supporting my depressed father after burying my mother. This was my first major wake-up call to let go of what had gone before and reset my life for living at a higher level. I'd thought I'd nailed it then, as the time I spent on the cancer journey was one of the most uplifting of my life, yet it didn't hold. The true transformation took a while longer. On the outside, I put the illness and losses behind me, and it looked okay. I found a new and wonderful work. I bought a house. I made new friends. I remarried. I rebuilt a life. Yet, as I sat alone in that Cardiff Millennium Stadium in Wales, watching Madonna, the pain overwhelmed me. And I knew I could no longer pretend to be happy, whole, or at one with myself. I had many mantras going through my head, things that had righted me in the past. I'm a weeble, I wobble, but I don't fall down. That was the advertising slogan in the 70s of the Weeble toys, which had weighted bottoms to keep them from falling over when rocked. The trouble is that for most of my life, I'd look like I would bounce back, and I would even do so temporarily. But it was taking a huge internal, emotional, and physical toll. Never more did I need the array of fixes to keep me from falling than when I ran my PR company in the 90s. Negative things such as alcohol, anger, sleeping tablets, or allowing my subconscious to take charge of my appearance and keep my body a size zero via bulimia. On a positive side, good things such as acupuncture, massage, Ayurvedic medicine, psychotherapy, hypnotherapy, colonics, kinesiology, flotation tank therapy, and more kept me going. But all the latter were just like plasters holding me together. The former often just numbed the pain. I'd launched my PR company with a 5,000 redundancy package in my spare room with my basset hound Rosie as my first member of staff. 3 years later, its turnover was £250,000 and we were getting noticed. We had great staff, nice officers, and we were winning pretty much everything we pitched for, yet I was miserable. It all felt so burdensome. At night, I couldn't sleep. I felt like I had to keep spinning plates on poles. I was handling the UK PR for arguably the world's greatest motivational guru, Tony Robbins, and going through his premier live course, Mastery University. I was learning all about my internal dialogue. I was digging deep for my values. I was tapping into my inner power. I then went on to represent Brandon Bays and Robert Holden and Edward de Bono. So I embraced their teachings to heal many past wounds and develop a deeper understanding of myself. I even felt happy some of the time. For years, I tried without success to get pregnant. I tried every complementary therapy and medical procedure, apart from the IVF I was offered, because by then I was so fed up with it. I didn't want the process anymore. What I didn't realize at the time were two things. Firstly, my mind was saying to my body, "Are you crazy? You can barely get through your 12-hour day fueled by adrenaline and coffee. You don't sleep at night due to worry. And you want to grow a healthy baby in this environment. You even want to time the birth so you can be back at work within 48 hours. No deal." Secondly, my immune and hormonal system was highly compromised, having been depleted through years of taking antibiotics as a child to counter early and nearly dying of whooping cough and German measles when I was 18 months old. So I thought it was normal to have constant tonsillitis, an emergency tonsillectomy at 26, repeated glandular fever, no period, psoriasis, IBS, shingles, as I arrived in my 30s. This compromised health came back to haunt me in the Bahamas. The PR company had soared up to over £1 million and we were winning a string of awards. We'd been bought out. I thought I'd dodged a bullet by getting out of the rat race alive. I was a vegan. My size zero body was honed to perfection as I ran 5 kilometers every morning before the gym. And then I started to feel run down. I thought it was flu. I found a lump in my breast following a mammogram that had said I was fine. I thought it was a cyst. My diagnosis came the day before Good Friday. I was 43 years old. Given the type of breast cancer, invasive lobular carcinoma, and having young children, I chose to go to the Moffitt Cancer Clinic in Tampa, Florida, not just because of its outstanding reputation, but because it was an independent clinic. And I felt that some of the other hospitals were in the pocket of Big Pharma and were bound to suggest a very oncological course of treatment. 3 weeks later, just before I was on the operating table, something spiritual and amazing happened. But perhaps more of that later. What happened in terms of my life is that following a chance conversation at a party shortly before the cancer treatment, we discovered a 10-acre farm on an out island in Eleuthera, which means freedom in Greek, in the Bahamas, was available. It had been mothballed. What better place to recover from my treatment than an organic farm that fronted one of the most beautiful pink sand beaches in the world? We moved there. And for 2 years, we lived on the land and the sea. I'd haggle daily with the local fishermen for their catches, adding fish to my otherwise vegan diet because I was so underweight. The farm was abundant with fruit. We grew mixed salads, watercress. I had eggplant, courgettes, carrots, and onions. And I purchased bushels, which I found out was a large cardboard box full, of amazing mangoes. I swapped homemade bread for tuna. I distilled noni juice. I meditated. I read. I watched only positive movies. I walked the beach with my dogs, and it was one of the most uplifting and amazing times of my life, and I recovered fully. But the challenges continued. Will Poulsen's words became my mantra. Strong trees do not grow with ease. The stronger the wind, the stronger the trees. That's when it imploded. My father's stroke, on my birthday for good measure, had preceded the cancer in me. Then after my treatment, or during my treatment, the farm was destroyed by 2 hurricanes. And at that time, after the phone was reconnected, I had a call telling me that my mother had terminal pancreatic cancer. My children had little stability as I spent the best part of those 2 years in hospital, in America for me, or in the UK for my father and mother. I then discovered that the bedrock, the financial safety I'd sacrificed everything for, worked so hard for, was pretty much gone. Poor investments from a husband trying to hold it together. The marriage didn't last after that. I had to go home with practically nothing. It was a time of intense pain and overwhelm. Not only did I have to freeze what was left of our money, I literally had what I could physically load onto a BA flight out of Nassau with the kids. I then found I was not entitled to any support from UK social services for 6 months upon my return. So I had to sell my best, most treasured jewellery to support myself and the mother. Now a single mother with no bank assets, two young children, my dear father gifted me his car and he paid for the rental on a small house I found. And just as I watched my mother die from pancreatic cancer, my husband, for good measure, brought criminal charges after me. 3 days after the funeral, I opened my door. There were two police officers. They seized our passports. A bailiff arrived half an hour later and served me with a writ to appear in the High Court of London, faced with charges of abducting my own children from our country of residence. I was reeling. I managed to pick them up. After swimming class, I remember sitting by that hot, humid pool, shouts of fun and laughter, feeling utterly bereft, exhausted to my core. I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep, I could barely breathe. That night, I popped out three packets of heavy-duty sleeping pills. I sat on the bed, I looked at them scattered across the bedding, thinking how easy it would be to just grab a handful, open a bottle of wine and sink into oblivion to stop the pain. Yet I didn't. I couldn't check out and leave my children or my father. I felt there was love and hope and support somewhere. I had to reconnect with it, and I did. I moved to be near my father. We won the court case, and I spent many years making up lost time with him. I became head of marketing and communication for the Leprosy Mission charity, and spent times of pure privilege with some of the poorest and most marginalized people in the world. Hearing their stories, seeing their courage, gave me my sense of self back. This period of challenges and upheavals came to a head watching Madonna that night, and I had the inner strength to reset my life once more.
Inner strength. Roz has it in spades. As does Shayna Jasmine. It takes a lot of strength to write a letter to say goodbye.
Dear alcohol, it's been 164 days since we were last together. Feels longer, doesn't it? I wasn't sure whether I should write this letter. I was scared of the feelings it would bring up. They say that there is no benefit in going backwards and digging up the past, and I get that now. But with you, for us, there's too much left unresolved. I just woke up one day and I didn't want you anymore, and I think you deserve to know why, so here goes. I didn't really even like you at first, but all my friends did, so I just thought there must be something about you. We hung out more and more, always with other people, and I guess you grew on me. In fact, we had some bloody good times over the years, but I think things took a turn when we started hanging out just the two of us. Don't get me wrong, you were there for me when nobody else was, when nobody else understood me. And I'm grateful for that. But I think you played on my vulnerability and took advantage when I wasn't in the best headspace. Maybe you didn't mean to. I don't know. I don't really want to know. But in time, you took control of me in the subtlest of ways. You see, I didn't need you. I knew that, and you knew that. But yet you just kept convincing me otherwise. I was lonely, and you were there. I thought I could only be myself around you. But the truth is, I wasn't me at all. With you or without you, you changed me. I didn't even know who I was anymore. The people in my life were getting further and further away from me, and now I know that it was because of you. I'm not saying you did it on purpose, but maybe I wouldn't have hurt and upset so many people if we hadn't gotten so close. I'm not blaming you for everything that's happened, and I'm not even angry with you. I'm angry with me. It was all my fault, but you definitely didn't help. It's weird because you were so not good for me. You were literally destroying me, even though I didn't want to admit it. But I won't lie. I miss you a little bit. I miss the comfort you brought me. Not enough to want you back. But I, like I said, there were some good times. So I guess this is goodbye. It's also a request. If you see me around, please don't talk to me.
Don't even look in my direction, because the truth is, although I know I'm so much better off without you, I mean, look at me, I'm smashing life, finally. Better late than never, I guess. But yeah, I'm not sure I could handle it. You have a way of pulling me back in, and I'm not quite ready to test this newfound strength of mine. Not yet, anyway. So as much as it would have been nice if you could have stuck around, we both know that would just have ended in disaster, like a huge end-of-the-world type disaster. So please, just don't. We had 20 years of ups and downs, and I'm afraid too many of those were downs. So now, my friend, I need to do the next 20 on my own. Thank you for each and every lesson. Shayna.
So many lessons to learn. Alcohol plays a role in most of our lives, but it affects each one of us differently. Sometimes, however, alcohol might not be the only problem. The person drinking it might be too, as Viv Parry's characters discover in the bar.
This is a favourite haunt. The big mirrored wall behind the bar bounces light around. Everything is rich and bright. The bottles diving to their optics are shiny, colourful and intriguing, filled with exotic choices. The bartenders in their tall handsomeness glide elegantly around. They have small aprons tied neatly just below their slim waists. The aprons have a pocket at the front containing a bottle opener and their small pads, which they occasionally use to take orders. However, they prefer to demonstrate their prowess by memorising orders, but the pad is there just in case. There is a crisp white towel tucked over the apron strings. One of the bartenders is flamboyantly mixing a cocktail. His every gesture exaggerated. It is a theatrical performance. This drama is partly what draws Karen and her daughter here. They also love the mini acts being played out by the customers. The polished businessmen grouped together, their voices loud and rich with confidence. There are couples too. Prosperous men with young, manicured and stiffly coiffured, jewelled women with nipped waists hanging onto their every word and their thick wallets. Karen stands at the bar surveying the scene. She feels out of place but holds her space. She perches on a brass-studded, pale-tan leather bar stool. "Here you are, madam," says the waiter, his French accent making the outdated term more palatable. He places two large glasses down on the copper bar. Beneath each is a small folded black napkin, then a Perspex wine cooler containing their favourite bottle of white wine. Just then, Karen's daughter appears at her shoulder. They hug. "Shall I bring the drinks to a table for you?" says the bartender. As ever, the service levels have suddenly increased with the arrival of Karen's beautiful daughter. Bea is dressed in a neat black dress. She is taller than Karen, despite her flat patent moccasin shoes. Her dress has a little Peter Pan collar. "Yes, please, that would be lovely," Karen replies to the bartender. They choose a place to sit. There are four tall marble tables in front of a high, long leather bench seat facing the bar. They sit behind one of these tables, placing their bags on the bench at either side of themselves. The bartender appears. With a swift, efficient flourish, he places small black napkin squares on the table, then the glasses. "Would you like me to pour for you?" says. "Yes, please," says Bea, smiling sweetly. Karen is proud of Bea's confidence, her lovely nature. He pours the chilled wine into the glasses, which quickly mist. The whole process is rich with anticipation of the lovely evening ahead, exchanging stories and gossiping about the dramas on the stage laid out before them. The bartender places the bottle into the wine cooler he's already set down on the table. "Thank you," says Bea. "Could we have some water, please?" asks Karen. "Of course, madame, still or sparkling?" he replies slightly impatiently. "One sparkling and one still, please," says Karen. Karen asks Bea how her day has been, and they are off. Karen revels in the fact that her children are now grown. They are unhooked from her, and she can talk without responsibility. They are friends. The waiter returns. More black napkins and two tall, elegantly slim glasses of water are placed on the table. Karen watches in anticipation as the bubbles bounce around her glass. The cool of the water creates a thin film of condensation around the glass. They resume their chat. Then Karen becomes conscious of the men gathered around the table next to Bea. They are laughing noisily, drinking from large glasses heavy with scarlet wine. The man closest to Bea stays seated but shuffles closer to her. What do you do? He slurs. I'm a solicitor, she replies. Ah, he leers. Well, you are very lucky today, he continues, leaning towards her. Karen slides towards the edge of the high bench and looks over to him. I'm the partner of a firm of solicitors in town. His lips are stained with red wine. His words run into each other. I bet you don't often get the chance to talk to a partner, do you? He places heavy emphasis on the word partner. B turns towards Karen. Shifting slightly, she turns her back to him. He's unperturbed. Here's my card, he says, fumbling into his pocket to retrieve the card. Thank you, says B, smiling once again. Karen and B talk. Karen does not take her eyes off him. He leans over again and places another card in B's bag. Karen feels the anger rising but does not move. Then he leans closer still and places a card in B's lap, close to the hem of her dress, which sits about 6 inches above her knee. Karen snaps. She walks around the table and stands in front of him. You seem a bit annoyed, he says, leering and turning his face towards B, as if she and he might enter into some sort of conspiracy against the madly flailing mother. He stands up. In doing so, he brings a glass smashing to the floor. The red wine pools on the table, then drips down on top of the shattered glass. Karen returns to her seat. One of the other men at the table nod apologetically in Karen and B's direction. They usher their friend into his long black coat. He shuffles towards Karen. He stands in front of her, his large frame swaying. What did I do wrong? He asks. I'll explain to you another time when you're sober, says Karen. She feels a slight thrill of superiority as she's only had a small amount of drink so far. He continues to leer at B. Then he is gone. I'm sorry, he sometimes doesn't know when to stop, his friend says to them. I think he's been out since lunchtime. We just joined him an hour or so ago, as by way of mitigation and abdication of responsibility. It's okay, says B. They resume their evening.
It's not okay. Not even remotely. Some things in life do not have to be inevitable. Still, as seas carve coastlines, it was always inevitable that Ben Masters would provide us with a powerful reading.
As seas carve coastlines. My father was 13 when the war broke out. He was walking home from school one day in September 1940, when he saw one of the first Luftwaffe bombs fall from the sky over London. It fell not too far from his house. He thought little of it at the time. The next day, he and his 10-year-old brother were evacuated to Haywards Heath. Their 8-year-old sister was sent to Eastbourne. At the railway station, when he first arrived, people passed him and his brother by. We were a little annoyed. They wanted girls. Some say the first casualty of war is innocence. Others, the truth, but perhaps it's choice. My father wanted to study science A-levels. They were his passion. He ended up studying French, English and Latin from scratch. He loved football, but there weren't any official teams to join. He and friends kicked an old footy about in Scrubland after school. He loved art. Art supplies were hard to come by. And yet, he looked back fondly on those times. He recalled with affection his school class chasing after their English teacher, Mr. Wilson, along country lanes, they on foot, the teacher on his bike. Mr. Wilson would recite G.K. Chesterton's The Ballad of the White Horse as the kids ran breathlessly behind. And so, during those early formative years of his life, the hedgerows and fields of Haywards Heath were his entire world. And far from home, with limited options and few luxuries, he learned some of life's essential truths. He learned of life's unpredictability, the importance of playing the hand you're dealt, the need to make do, the need to get on with things. His actions were informed by certain unspoken values, an absence of entitlement, a keen realization that life could be worse and that others have it far worse than you. Never take anything too seriously, least of all yourself. Nothing is ever as bad or as good as you think it is. The father I knew was never one to make a fuss. Indefatigably unflappable, he never lost his cool, an important quality, I imagine, when in 1973, the year I was born, he became headmaster of Britain's largest school at the time. One of the first purpose-built comprehensives, St. Kevin's in Kirby, Merseyside. It had over 2,000 boys. It was a tough job in a tough area, but he fell in love with the place. All boys remember him more for his tea and sympathy than his reliance on the cane. One of his first changes as head was to get rid of streaming, which he felt lowered expectations and encouraged complacency. He hated the way those in lower sets were expected to do less well than the rest. He felt that teachers should be ambitious for every child. The war steered his life course. In his 58 years of teaching, he taught those subjects chosen for him by wartime, French, English, and Latin, along with history and Greek for good measure. And I, in turn, went on to share his love of languages and went into teaching. And so his wartime went on to shape me, and so back to the present. The current pandemic will shape, as surely as seas carve coastlines, young people today. We're right to worry about them, and much needs to be done. But I don't doubt they're learning many of the lessons my father learned through the privations of war.
Thankfully, many of us have not had to fight in a war, but there are often battles that test us to the limit. Chrissy Lowry has had more than her fair share.
The last person that died was my nana, and she was the real close person in my life. And that was on my 18th birthday. And at that time, I was living in a mother and baby's home because I'd had a child really very young to an older person, and that was the abusive relationship. So my life was all over the place right back then. I then found a job in a garage and I started being a mechanic. Wow. And my dad was a mechanic, so that made me feel close to him in a weird way. And then I seemed to have got myself together for my 20s. My 20s, as I wrote in my story, was a really good time. I emigrated to New Zealand. I found that I liked to work within the special needs service. And I joined the special educational needs service over in New Zealand. I lived with a wicket keeper over there. He was a professional wicket keeper.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we still keep in touch. So that was it. That was an incredible time and I absolutely loved it. I came back after a year. I bought my first house. I went back to college and I got a diploma. And then I got a really good job in a residential autistic home as a manager there. And I did that with two homes. And then I became aware of, I think it was a lady who was like an assessor said, oh, I think you're wasted here. You should do your nurse training. I was like, oh.
Suddenly it hit.
Yeah, I thought, even though I love the job, I thought, yeah, I think there's something more I can do. So I became a nurse, mental health nurse specialist. And I did that for, I think, 15 years. And in that time, I had three children. I had twins and they came 3 months early and they were very sick and I was very sick. Okay. And that's probably why Zach has autism. So if you look back through my life, it's been preparing me for I have two sons with extra needs. You know, I had the jobs and I had all the training and it's very strange and sort of pushed me into sort of being able to handle it. And that's when I started first, I reckon around that time. It was a very highly stressful time, obviously. And then I started getting diagnosed with things, which brings me up to my 40s.
One thing after another, it can often feel like everything is geared against us. It can make us question ourselves. Who am I? What am I? Yulia Farkash asks these questions as she looks closer at our personal stories.
I'm nobody. Stripped bare down to my last molecule. I am not my mistakes, my sorrows, my fears, my weaknesses. I am not my trials, my comparisons, my tribulations, my limitations. I am not what other people think or say. Then what am I? I am the space in which my stories show up. I am the shaper and the shifter. I am the dealer and the healer. I am the dreamer and the doer. I am the winner and the loser. I am the leader and the follower. I am the comer and the goer. I am the inner and the outer. I am the fixer and the failure. I am the creator and the destroyer. So who am I? I'm nobody, because I can be anybody. So I am free, just be.
Yes, let's just be. Does looking around us at what everyone else is doing make us feel good, or does it make us feel squashed? Tricia Lewis, what do you think?
I'm going to take you back to the summer of 1976. It was hot. But I was at art school, so that sort of heat mixed with the smell of turpentine and wood shavings and oil paint was heady, shall we say. So I was in my first month of a foundation course, and everyone was very creative. It was the 70s, for goodness sakes. There were crazy stuff going on. And once a week, we had a session where the tutors got together and they looked at people's things that they'd created. And on this particular occasion, there was one piece that was drawing a lot of attention. Oh, it was just amazing. The tutors were drooling with admiration. No, it wasn't mine. It was a star pupil. And let me describe this thing that was creating such a buzz. It was kind of a piece of plywood, about 8x8. And on it were stuck tampons. And each one had red paint on it at different levels. Something about representing the state of woman, blah, blah, blah. Right, so I'm stood there, and at this point thinking, why am I here? I don't belong. I hate this pretentious rubbish. What is the point? I'm really good at figure drawing. And yes, I'm trying to design a Perspex hamburger at the moment, but I hate every minute of what I'm doing because I'm only doing it trying to be clever and please the tutors. So I guess what I was experiencing was a form of what I call conflicted conformity. I wanted to fit in. I wanted to be down with the cool girls and guys, and I wanted to run away, thinking, this isn't me, this isn't me, this isn't me. So anyway, I ran away. That was the tipping point. I ran away to find my way in the world, to stake my... What I actually did was I went to the job centre in my local town and got a job as a sales assistant at Mothercare, which was a new thing back in the day. Tiny little store, summer of 76, no air conditioning and a nylon uniform. It was memorable. But I did feel I've done it. I've done my thing. It's not about anything fancy, but I'm here and I'm earning money and I've made a... And then sure enough, my lovely father, a very successful businessman, got me an interview, and I ended up somehow getting onto a management training course at Harrods. Yet again, conflicted conformity. And 18 months later, I ran away from that. And this pattern continued, dear listener. For many years, many, many years, because nowhere in all of this had I really found and owned and released me. I was prey to people's, you should do this, you should do that. And sort of rebelling inside with this kind of power that wouldn't come out and this, oh, but I want to be liked.
Wanting to be liked, wanting to be part of something. Seeing the world pass us by. Life takes us in many directions, as Garima Nab will tell you.
When I first open my eyes, I see light. There are noises around me. I am afraid. I am handed from one person to another. I don't know them. but finally find myself staring at a face filled with love. I feel happy. As I am fed, I grow. As I grow, I learn to walk. As I walk, I start running. As I run, I also fall. I meet others like me. We become friends. We play together, sometimes fight together. I get a lot of toys, but I didn't like sharing. That caused problems. My friends didn't like it. I go to a place called school where I learn. At first, I didn't want to go. I cried for my mother. But as I meet others, I enjoyed it. We played together, even got into trouble. My parents want me to study, want me to be something. But I am enjoying my life. What more is there? As I grow older, I get pressured by family and society. Even though I work hard, I'm not really happy. As I grow older, books become my friends. As I deal with other people, their expectations increase. But no matter what I do, no one can be satisfied. It breaks my heart seeing people change. I fall in love thinking I have found the one. But alas, I get heartbroken. I still get married, loved or not. I have children, finding joy in them. I continue working hard to support my family. Despite my efforts, the boss won't treat me fairly. I go home tired, only to find my partner has left me. I become distraught. How do I take care of the children? I continue working like an animal on a farm. I grow older, yet continue to support my children. As my children grow older, they spend more time with their friends. No one wants me. I live alone now. I look down at my fragile body. Who will take care of it? When my time comes, where will I go? When everyone abandons me, it's then I ask, who am I?
It's a huge question, but there are certain moments in life that make us question it even more than others. As Clive Bartlett found out.
1990, London. Joining the crowd at Whitehall, something felt different. The mood had changed. The drums, whistles, and good-natured banter of earlier, all gone. Ahead of me, a heavy police presence moved in. The crowd scatters and a banner unfolds. It reads, "Community, charge!" So they do, as do the police. For a photography student with a few shots left, this is gold. "Hold this." A man behind me climbs some scaffolding. "Quick, give it me." Little idea of what's going on, I hand it back. Second later, what I was holding is launched towards a line of police. "From the press," comes another voice, thinking of my feet. Watford College Express. "Cool, get this." Together with three others, he rams a bench into a police horse. "Did you get it? Want us to do it again?" No, I don't. Amongst the chaos, it was surprisingly easy to get close to the action. But lowering my camera and taking it all in, this wasn't for me. This was no longer about the poll tax. It was about mindless destruction. And for some, grabbing 15 minutes of fame in the media. It was bullshit. "You photographers are fueling this violence," shouts a policeman. There was much more to it than that. But in part, he actually had a point.
Our actions always have consequences. It's not always somebody's fault, but by looking back at the past as objectively as possible, we can learn and make things better for future generations. It wasn't easy for Gary Nightingale to look back, but we are grateful that he did.
A Saturday evening in early August 1979, we are eating our dinner in the lounge from trays on our laps, sausages and mash with peas fresh from the garden. Mum and Dad sit on the sofa. My sister and I are positioned on mismatched armchairs either side of the sofa. My left arm is in a sling, having cracked a bone on the last day of term. We were playing a ball game on the grass behind our classroom hut. As I reached into the air for the ball, I was body tackled from behind by Stephen Gordon, a strange whispering boy with a perpetual unsettling smile and a hangdog face mottled with freckles. The taciturn young Gordon dragged me sharply to the ground and I landed on my elbow. In those days of limited communication and with no transport, somehow Mum managed to get me to Torbay Hospital. After waiting for hours to be seen, I was sent for an x-ray. Stephen had cracked my humerus. They gave me a sling and we went home. That summer, I fell in love with music. On the beach, as the other village kids swam and splashed in the sea, I sat on the shingle with a transistor radio. The songs I heard then still raise the hairs on the back of my neck. I Can't Stand Losing You by The Police. My Sharona by The Knack. I Don't Like Mondays by The Boomtown Rats. And the first single I bought, Pop Music by M. Blondie, two-tone, new wave, popular culture's response to the aftermath of punk. Sid Vicious, who I've not yet heard of, died in February. Later this year, The Clash will release the album London Calling, perhaps the last true punk record. I discovered this new world in about 4 years when I ventured beyond the safety of the top 40 and start listening to John Peel. I once took that radio apart. The housing was made of plywood. As I sat on that beach, alone but for the songs crackling and whining from my wooden treasure box, the dynamics that would tear me to pieces lay dormant in the shadowed corners of my soul. Nobody knew they were there. It will take me a long time to realise I never had to do any of what followed, to understand that at any time, in any of the innumerable moments that make up the lost years of my late teens and early adulthood, I could have just stopped. To the people around me, I could simply have said, I'm leaving, and just walked away with no guilt, no regret, and without even a backward glance, and started again. But I didn't. It never occurred to me. I didn't know I could just do that. I didn't know I had a choice, which is the same as having no choice. We sit and eat our meal. We've all had our birthdays for the year, apart from my sister, who will be 9 in September. Dad is 33, Mum is 31, I am 12. We are watching Chips. Later we may watch a movie. Jaws is on again. In just a few days' time, ITV will shut down almost completely as technicians go on strike over pay. For now, however, there are 3 fully active channels, the 4th not due to air for another 3 years. There is no video, not in this house anyway. There's no iPlayer, no catch-up TV, no Netflix, no YouTube. You watch it when it's on or you miss it. In December, our new Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, will introduce the Right to Buy housing bill. One day in the far future, Mum will make her last payment on the council house in which we now sit and eat. Recession and more strikes threaten. Towards the end of the summer, the IRA will continue their campaign of terror by assassinating Earl Mountbatten. Across the Atlantic, Jimmy Carter has 2 more years left of his presidency. The world turns, but none of it really touches us in any direct, discernible way. Our family does not relate to any class or culture. We endure the poverty of the working class without the proud identity. We occasionally strive towards a superficial mimicry of the middle class, but lack its stability and self-assurance. Our fortunes fluctuate as rapidly as Dad's erratic cycling moods. Our income is as sporadic as his changeable and rootless ideas. We live in a frozen and isolated bubble. This bubble is made of glass and it bears a label. The label reads Bell's Whiskey. Their tagline is Afore Ye Go. But no one goes. No one goes anywhere. No one is permitted to leave. That is our identity. That is our culture, but it is hidden. No one's allowed to talk about it. No one's allowed to go to the cluttered outside toilet and reach up to the ridge above the door where, lurking in the cobwebs, sits a half bottle of this evening's brooding amber supply. No one is allowed to pick through the hedge separating the back garden from the fields beyond and unearth the empty bottles, the labels faded and decayed and crawling with woodlice. It is forbidden to climb onto a chair and crawl through the hatch into the loft, to retrieve more of those empty bottles nestling in the poorly distributed lagging between the beams. The entire house is a complex maze of narrow walkways through heavily defended no-go zones, One must tread these paths with care, breath held and eyes wide. We live by one rule, a rule so deeply entrenched we are not even aware it exists. That rule is silence.
Silence in a different context can also be a chance to reflect. That's something worth doing more of if we want to avoid the ever-growing possibility of burnout, a subject very close to Carol Miltensteiner's heart.
Burnout, a drama in three acts. Act one, I have barely time to breathe, we say. Days fly by. Is it Thursday already? We get angry at our boss, angry at our colleagues, angry at our customers, angry at ourselves. We want to save the world, and we wanted to do it better than anyone. The world keeps applauding us. People seem to enjoy the race. Time slips through our fingers. It is never enough. One more coffee, one more sleepless night. There is no time to breathe. Until one day, at the worst possible time, there is no air, and the fire goes out. Act two. The body is exhausted. The mind is paralyzed. The days drag on. We just want tomorrow to come, because maybe tomorrow we will feel better. The world moves on around us, and it's too fast. Where is the strength that was here? How did this happen to me? Stop asking difficult questions, we say when someone says, are you okay? Everything is exhausting. Days and nights are a blur. Endless medical appointments, endless exams, endless prescriptions. It seems that we'll never be able to live a normal life again. We try to go back to normal for way too long. Until one day, we realize that normal is invented. That our normal can be invented by us. It can be anything we want. And the flame slowly reignites. Act three, the sun shines through our bedroom window again. We spent months, perhaps years, in the dark. At the same time, it feels like it's been so fast. The days have a spark of joy again. We are again able to make a promise and keep that promise. We understand our limits. We come to grips with our traumas. We allow ourselves to pursue our desires. We learn to walk again, to relate with others, to work. We are still jolted by our relapses, but we learn to live with them. Our essence is now visible, crystal clear. Life keeps shaking us from our center, throwing us back and forth, but we know now the way back. Things keep getting out of control, but now we laugh about it all. Now our fire can heat without hurting, and we learn day after day that we can shine without burning out.
We can shine, and we can help others to shine too, as Tracy Hooper was, well, maybe not willing, but kind enough to do for her daughter.
So my story is actually to do with my daughter. So my daughter has been and done some traveling, and then she came home and she wanted to get a career rather than just be doing sort of coffee shop and just casual work while she was traveling. So she came home, studied to do personal training and nutrition. And then last year, last summer, she was coming towards the sort of final stages of her her course and was going to take the exam. And she needed a case study to do some personal training with for 4 weeks, then to do the exam after 4 weeks. And then the program was set up for 12 weeks. Now, at this point, I was keeping my head well and truly down because I could see this coming my way and I didn't want it to come my way. I had seen her ask a couple of other people and for various reasons, they couldn't commit to it. So I was thinking, no, please don't ask me. I don't want to do three times a week and have to do it and stick to it. I came home one day and she collared me and said, Mum, and I thought, I know what this is going to be. And she said, would I be her case study for her? Well, you know, if you're a parent, you're probably the same as me. You can't say no, can you? So I said yes. We got training and she took me off to a gym and she did all these tests and all the rest of it, set me up my program. I did it for 4 weeks. We weren't in lockdown at the time, so we were able to go to a gym. However, we did go on holiday and then have to quarantine, so she had to adjust it slightly for us to do it at home. Then we went off to Portsmouth. She did the exam. She passed, I'm very pleased to say. Nothing to do with my efforts. It was all to do with her efforts. and then on 2 days later, she got on a plane and started off on her travels again, and she went off to Canada. And at that point, I was thinking, OK, so she set this program up for 12 weeks because she had to pass her exam. I've done it for three times a week for the past 4 weeks. I was actually quite enjoying it, and I was sort of there sort of thinking, am I going to continue with this, or do I just sort of slowly let it disappear now? Anyway, I thought, no, I'm going to keep going. I'm quite enjoying it. I've done exercise all through my life. I've done various things. Gym work kind of bored me a bit, but I've done classes. I've played squash. I've done all sorts of things, dance, and never really stuck at anything. But this kind of worked for me, and it was purely by chance, really, because it was for this exam. But actually, she's kind of hit on the thing that works for me. So we have been in lockdown. I carry on doing this at home. I still do it 3 times a week. And actually, I really enjoy it. And I'm a bit obsessed with it now, which is what happens, isn't it? That's what they say, get into a habit and then you don't want to get out of it again. And that's exactly what's happened. In fact, I wasn't very well a couple of weeks ago, missed it for a week. But then as soon as I was feeling better, I was like, right, back on it. And yeah, it's really good, really enjoying it. So the moral of the story is find the thing that works for you, really.
One person who has definitely found what works for him is the multi-story man, Andrew Thorpe. When you're ready, he'd like it if you sat next to him.
It must be about 4 years ago now, and I had to fly to America. It was a piece of work with a big insurance company, and I had to go from Heathrow to the US. And I'd never worked in the US before in this capacity. And with a long flight, I get bored very easily, and I have to have something to read. So I usually get a book, you know, if I go on a slightly longer flight from Smith's in the airport terminal. So, and I know I'm a storytelling person like you, and I should be reading fiction, but I'm a bit sad. So I bought this book, which was entitled something like How to Start a Conversation with Anyone. I thought that would be good reading on the plane. So I buy this thing. It's quite a striking cover. It's a black background with big yellow writing on the front with a title. So I get on the plane. It's a row of 3 seats. I've got a middle seat. And the guy's already in the window seat, but fast asleep. You know, he's got his blindfold on. He's ready to sleep the whole journey through. I sit down in my middle seat. I get my book out on my lap. I'm staring at the title. And then the guy comes to sit in the aisle seat. And I look up at him, and he looks at me, and he looks at the book title, and I look at the book title, and I look up at him, and he looks at me. And I just know he's thinking to himself, oh, my God, I'm sitting next to Del Griffith from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles for the next 8 hours, shower curtain ring salesman. What have I let myself in for? Can I find the stewardess to change my seat? So he could sense that I'd sensed his slight anxiety. And I smiled at him and he laughed. When I said, look, if you're uncomfortable about this, I can see you're anxious, then if you want to sleep, and that's absolutely fine with me. So we had a good giggle about it, and he sat down, and we spoke continually, and not just me, by the way, both ways, for 4.5 hours straight, because he turned out he was speaking at a conference in London. He was an American guy flying home. So I was asking him all about how that went, you know, what did you speak about? How did it go? And then he said, well, what do you do? And I explained what I do for a living. And he was so interested, and I was so interested, that we just hit it off. And it was one of those lovely little moments that you and I talk about quite a bit. It's the small, I mean, it's not a big story, is it? It's not like, you know, winning a gold medal or winning, you know, climbing Everest. It's a little, tiny, little funny exchange. But I always try and find a meaning from it. And I think one of the things there is that you often have these little moments of serendipity or unplanned exchanges, which turn out to be quite joyful when you're traveling.
Oh, a chat in a real place without the need for a virtual background. Wow. Maybe we'll get to record some of series 2 of the Storytelling with Puck podcast in person. But as we come to the end of the story of series 1, I'd personally like to thank each and every one of our guests for making this story happen. You have shared some of the most intimate parts of your lives. You have created fictional masterpieces. You have offered wisdom, humour, empathy, and so much more. Most importantly, you have used the power of story to connect with each other and every listener on a deeper level. To you, our listeners, you're the reason we do all of this. So thank you for listening and for encouraging us to keep going. Please subscribe on your favourite podcast platform. Give us a 5-star review and make sure you're caught up with every episode in Series 1, because this isn't the end. No, far from it. We'll be back very soon with Series 2 of the Storytelling with Puck podcast, and you are all welcome. Until next time, I've been your host Stefano, and this has been a Puck Creations production.